This is Frank Collada, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Collada Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Do you swear that the testimony that you are about to give before this subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yeah, I will.
Yeah, I will.
So when they take a silver dollar, they got to go around different banks and cash it in.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. We're back here in the second part of a two-part series with our good friend David Amoruso, Skype calling in from Europe. We're here in the Big Dumb Fun Show in the middle of Kansas City in the Ice House. My good friend Aaron is sitting over there at the control board right now. Aaron, say hello to everybody.
Hello, Aaron.
Oh, I said say hello to everybody. You should say say hello, everybody.
Because hello, everybody.
I know, I'm just teasing you. I have a little fun at your expense.
We didn't even know that Hello, Aaron was a thing until
we
did that episode at, we were interviewing Craig Glazier, the King of Sting, and there was a wiretapper who had come out to the recording session and came up to us and said, "You didn't say hello, Aaron."
Yeah, we got our good friend David Amoruso. Say hello, David.
Hello, everybody.
If you were going to follow it, Aaron would say, "Hello, David." But anyhow,
yeah,
we just have a little fun.
You know, in the last episode when we kind of talked about the Cray brothers, interesting kind of at the end of that, how the Cray brothers as a loose cannon had to kind of be put in line, and they were there at a casino in London, and they basically, these American guys who are American, La Cosa Nostra, coming over for, because they're the ones really operating the casino, right?
Right. They were from the Genovese family in New York, and they were kind of, it sounds like maybe George Raft was over there helping to on the spot, on the scene, to oversee their interest, and they also sent a guy over, kind of like Chicago Outfit sent Tony Spilotro out to Las Vegas. They had Lefty Rosenthal inside the casino to make sure everything was running smooth and the skim was running, but they sent Tony Spilotro out to do any kind of enforcement activities. And then they also had Tuffy DeLuna from Kansas City go out every once in a while to straighten some people out. So it's kind of the same sort of a thing. If it had been the Kansas City mob in the 60s and the Cray twins had come around, they would have sent Lefty, or they would have sent Tuffy DeLuna over to straighten them out if they needed some straightening out.
Yeah. I think that's their modus operandi. I think that's how they worked. That's how they ran things. It goes to show that they kept on doing that for decades after that as well. So in the 60s on to the 80s when it was in Las Vegas.
Well, I'm kind of interested in how the mob from America came over and helped out with the operations and gambling casinos in Europe. That seems like they would already have that kind of in their pocket.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, obviously everyone knows about Cuba and how they ran casinos in Havana until Castro came in and took everything over. And after that, after they lost Cuba, they started looking for other places that they could set up casinos and smoothly run everything without having a new dictator or a new rebel leader that would take everything from them away. So they started looking around, and you had obviously Meyer Lansky, the Jewish mob boss who worked closely with Luciano, who envisioned gambling as something that would be a pleasant pastime, which would be done by people, honorable people, if you will, not just by drunks, you know, flipping a coin and gambling on dice, but actually having a good time with some good alcohol, some fun women would be there, and just a great atmosphere. And Alansky was the first in the U.S. to revolutionize gambling operations. So he would actually turn them into these, they were known as carpet joints, which were, they had fine food and drinks, they had a good furniture, everything was just top-notch. And that basically set everything off. After that, it would just continue to expand. And once they had the know-how and they had the good people running the crapjack, the crap dealers, the roulette people, they had all these people working there. They had the expertise to export that to other countries. So once Cuba fell through, they started looking for other venues. And they they had their eyes on the Bahamas, which is a similar island as Cuba, which is pretty easy, easily corrupted. And they just set up their place there. Eventually, there was just too much exposure and heat on their operations, so they had to look yet again to some new place, and they ended up in Europe. So they started in London. They then moved on to the Netherlands, where they settled in Amsterdam. And in 1974, they actually had a delegation from the U.S. visiting Amsterdam to check out the local gambling market and to see if there would be a possibility to invest money in certain casinos there. And they got in contact with the local crime boss who ran the red light district in Amsterdam. And he also ran several small-time casinos. And they sat down with this guy and, basically made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. He would help offer protection to the casinos, and they would invest $1 million. Into a professional casino. It would be the first professional casino in the Netherlands because we had, there wasn't any illegal gambling. It was done by the state was allowed to run several casinos, but no one else was. So this was like pretty much anyone would like to gamble. So there were a lot of illegal casinos, but nothing that would really be impressive, nothing professional. And once the Italians came here, the Italian Americans, things just took off. And at that point, you had professionalized gambling in the Netherlands, run by people that were doing this kind of thing since Cuba. And it was actually done by one particular crew that was under Vincent Allo, the guy from the Genovese family. He was a soldier, but he ran a crew of associates, actually all brothers, three brothers, the Cellini brothers, Dino, Eddie, and Bobby. And these guys, they were just total professionals as far as gambling was concerned. They ran all these casinos for the mafia. And it was just this core group of people with Lansky, Vincent Allo, to protect them from the Cosa Nostra, Italian-American commission, if you will. And you had these guys basically doing everything for the mafia. So you had a core group, and they ran gambling schools where they educated their own personnel, and they would expand, export these people to London, to Amsterdam, to Germany, where they ran several casinos. So basically, that is how it all started out. And you had, at some point, you had local criminals helping out with protection, if it was possible, if a deal was arranged. And at other times, you had a guy like Charlie the Blade Turin, who would help out and offer his own protection to the casino operations in London or in a foreign country. So that pretty much is, in short, how they expanded across the world and how, basically they made a ton of money doing that.
So that's after Castro takes over Cuba and they made a little foray up into the Bahamas and then moved to Amsterdam where gambling is already legal. Now, that's Vincent Allo. That's the guy they called Jimmy Blue Eyes, I think.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
I always wondered, we have our friend Bill Friedman, who's a mob author, lives out in Las Vegas now, has written a kind of it's 30 years of gambling, 30 years of illegal gambling before the Strip, in which he talks about the carpet joints. And he talked a little bit about Vincent Allo, but not as much as the other, Frank Costello and Mayor Lansky. And he really, Allo has been under the radar, if you will, in the United States. He didn't have the name identification, and I suspect this may be a reason why he turned his interest, his attention to Europe and American, the FBI and American police were not too interested in what they were doing over in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those three brothers, Cellini, can you spell that? I'm not familiar with that name at all, and I don't. Many of our people may not. They probably want to Google that last name.
Yeah, Cellini is C-E-L-L-I-N-I.
Okay, thanks. Were they from New York? They were part of the Genovese family from New York?
No, they were from Steubenville, Ohio.
Oh, really? Interesting.
But that was pretty much another example of how back then, in those days, you had all these Cosa Nostra families throughout the U.S. You know, you had 26, I think, in total, and how they all were intertwined. So how you all had, like Al Capone was originally from New York, but then went to Chicago, and they still kept in touch. I think that's another example of these gangsters basically going all over the place, despite the fact that in those days you didn't really have transportation that you have now, or you know, you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have internet, and yet these guys were all over the place, and they had connections everywhere. They could go to Amsterdam, they could go to the Bahamas, and it was all good. And I think it shows the sophistication that these guys had, the knowledge that they had compared to the guys running things now. I think those guys were truly capable of running a large company, you know, like a Fortune 500 company. They were capable of that, but the guys running shit now might not be capable, I think.
Yeah, I've met people. I had this one guy who was kind of a source. He tried to use me all the time as his source, and I tried to use him as my source. But I once told him he had this sophisticated auto theft deal going, and I once told him, I said, man, I said, why don't you, you know, apply all those managerial and entrepreneurial skills and create a square business? I said, you could do well. He said, yeah, he said, but that wouldn't be much fun. So I think these guys, they have all this skill and ability to manage and understand relationships and create relationships and start businesses. You know, Bill Friedman, again, I'll quote him again, in Las Vegas when they first started trying to operate gambling casinos other than just as, a card game and a bar or a lounge.
Back room organizational.
They brought in mob guys because their experience in these carpet joints throughout the United States, and we had two or three here in Kansas City, they always locate them just outside the city and the county where they can pay off the county sheriff and people don't pay much attention to it anyhow. They had all the experience in how to run a casino. So the gaming commission out there turned a blind eye to a lot of those early people in the 50s to open and establish and operate casinos. And then by the 70s, that's when they started kicking everybody out and corporations took over. But it sounds like, I don't know, what about the progress of these gangster families, the Genovese family in the casinos in Amsterdam? How did that kind of progress? Did they expand into other cities in Europe? And I can't think, do other, like down in Germany and
Italy.
Italy.
Did they go back to Sicily?
Did they have casinos?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about when we're talking about the personnel and everything that they sent personnel out here to Amsterdam to teach these local Dutch dealers to how to work the game, how to run the casino. And these Dutch people, they didn't really like being told what to do and how to do it. So there was this kind of like this cultural divide, if you will, where they didn't really like it. At one point, you had these Italians, the Cellinis came over, and there was these Dutch tough guys working the casino as enforcers, as bodyguards, as, doormen. And the Cellinis came over. They didn't like the attitude of these guys. They actually wanted, they were used to respect. You know, when they walked into a restaurant or a club, they were respected and people would stand up and they would shake their hand. When they came to the Netherlands, that kind of stuff never happened. You had these Dutch muscle guys standing in front and they would just barely acknowledge them. And at one point, Jaap Cellini was actually fixing one of the slot machines in the casino in Amsterdam. And one of these big buff enforcer types threw a paper ball at Cellini's head. And, you know, Cellini was just out of his mind. He was pissed off. And he actually went to the crime boss who was tasked with running and protecting these casinos for the Americans to, you know, hand out some kind of disciplinary action. He was actually very surprised that no such thing happened. You know, he was just like, well, you know, just a slap on the wrist, just like, don't do that kind of stuff. You know, don't piss off these Italians. It was all done very much like is common in this country, where you just basically, everyone is equal. Everyone has a right to, you know, speak his mind and to just accept what the other person is saying. So everything just went away very calmly. And, you know, Cellini was so pissed off, and he actually, you know, he had to accept the reality of operating a casino in a foreign country at that point. But he did say, according to sources, who at the time were talking to reporters, he actually said, you know, if you had done this in my country, you know, you would have been a dead man by now. So that's one of those instances where you have people from two different cultures crashing into each other. And this had all to do with the professionalism of the crew that they were used to working with. So I think that's interesting to see how difficult it is to not only get qualified personnel, but also to have personnel that realizes, you know, who they are dealing with. That's one of the issues that the Cellinis ran into when they were operating abroad.
Well, here's a kind of a question, because here in America, the local mob, whether it be in Kansas City or Chicago, they work the local political machine. They work the system. They got inside the government, so to speak, inside the police department. And was that as easy or possible for them to do in places like the Netherlands or other European countries?
I think it was a lot more difficult. I think in London and the Netherlands, it might have been possible. I think that especially local police, they would definitely pay them off just to get a tip if there was a raid or if there was any investigation going on. But I don't think the politicians were very difficult to get to. I don't think corruption on that level isn't as common as it is, you know, in other countries. So in Western Europe, that doesn't really happen as often. But the police, they definitely had those on the payroll and would, you know, get tips. And they would actually, you know, look the other way while this casino, which was illegal, was being set up in the middle of Amsterdam. You know, this was in the center. This was in, you know, you had the prostitutes, which was semi-legal in the Netherlands. And then you had this illegal casino, which, you know, the police knew it was happening, but they didn't do anything about it. In that respect, I think that they were corrupt, but it wasn't on the same level as, you know, as some politicians were bribed or anything like that. That didn't
or happen. Judges.
At least not that we know of. It might have, but, you know, that hasn't come out yet. And if it did, it probably would have come out by now. But this was the 70s, and, you know.
Yeah, I agree. It would have been out by now. You know, up in Chicago, they even had judges paid off. They got a couple of guys, Tony Splatro and Harry Edelman, a couple of hitmen up there, both got not guilty on the murder. They had a pretty slick deal. They would opt for a bench trial or a trial in front of a judge without a jury. And if the defendant wants that, why, the state's going to give it to them. Well, the judge was already paid off. And against all the evidence, at the end, judge says not guilty, and they walk free. They even retried one guy because it was so blatant, it was so bad. And I think Splatro would have retried him on his, but and then he got killed himself, and Edelman got killed also. What about, are there other, these are legal casinos already that they've infiltrated, just like they did in Las Vegas. Now, was there legal gambling, say, in Belgium or Germany that they moved into?
This was actually illegal gambling. There was no legal gambling. You had legal casinos, but those were all run by the government, so you couldn't infiltrate them. But they actually set up this casino and the same one in London. They were illegal, but you know, it wasn't really. It was basically just a crime to operate a casino if you didn't have a license. That's what they did. But if you look at the casino or the gambling laws in Europe, they're very diverse. So you have at various points, you have governments that would allow gambling if they could run it themselves. So you have in Belgium and Netherlands, they can, the government runs casinos or certain places where they have slot machines and those kinds of stuff, the poker machines, that kind of. But no gambling where they have a dealer. You can't have that. You can't have a human running stuff. So you have a casino, and there's like a couple of them in the Netherlands, and you have a couple of them in Belgium where you have actually personnel running it. You can play roulette, you can play cards, you can do all that kind of stuff. And then you have several other places where there's just video poker machines and slot machines. It's all machines. And you have to have a license from the government. And the government is the only one that can run a casino. So they won't hand out any license. So right now you have the problem with gambling at this point is online gambling, because you can't really stop that. You can't stop a Dutch person or a Belgian person or a German person from gambling online. So they're looking into opening up the gambling market and giving outsiders a chance to bid on a license. But as far as the illegal and legal side of the casino business and the gambling business, it's very complicated, if you will, because there's just different rulings and different ideas about that. You know, if you go to Belgium, it's a different. If you go to England, it's different. If you go to Germany, so that's the biggest issue when you're looking at gambling throughout the decades, by the way, because this has been playing for so long, and it just seems like for some reason we can't fix this. We can't really find a consensus on how to handle this. So I don't know.
So you have quite a little bit of government, shall we say, government-sponsored or government-sanctioned casinos and video poker operations where it's nothing but machines. And of course, you've got a national lottery, I believe, over there. And what about gambling on the football or the, I guess, in soccer? That had to be huge. Is there government-sponsored sports betting?
The same, yeah. The government has taken over gambling. It's the same like, I think it was, Dutch Schultz in Harlem who had the numbers racket. And then, you know, once that was a success, eventually the government took it from him or from his successors. And now they run the lottery in the U.S. as well. And it's the biggest thing, you know. It starts out as something that is illegal, and then the government takes it. I think that's pretty much how it works, you know, if it's weed or if it's gambling. It pretty much comes down to it. If it makes money and it doesn't hurt a lot of people, the government is interested in, you know, running it themselves. And I think that's happened with gambling and, weed or medicinal drugs.
Yeah, it's got to be hard in a country like the Netherlands, where if your organization is all about operating vice and you're in direct competition to do that with the government,
really,
it's got to be hard to make a living.
Well, the funny thing about the Dutch casinos actually is that they ran a loss, and it doesn't really, something smells fishy when a casino is losing money.
Somebody's skimming.
Exactly, but you know, you don't know for sure. But they're not doing as good as they used to. They're actually talking about a bankruptcy for these casinos. So there's something going on that, you know, you would expect that the criminals would have a difficult time, when in reality, because the Netherlands is known as a free country with a lot of these ICEs on offer, that there's people from France, from England, from Italy, from Spain, Portugal, everyone is coming to the Netherlands to, you know, see these vices, to experience these vices. So there's so much action going down that there's enough for everyone. And it's also, the Netherlands especially has become sort of like a transit country where people from South America and all these other countries, they come and they get together and they organize drug pipelines. So, you know, you get drugs from South America, you bring it to the Netherlands or Belgium. There's two big ports. You've got one in Antwerp in Belgium, and you've got one in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. The drugs comes in, and from the Netherlands, you can ship it anywhere. You can, you know, there's no borders. So you can just drive your truck to Italy, to Spain, or wherever, you know. Obviously, there's checks and whatnot, but it's not as like there's a customs every, you know, border you get. It doesn't happen. So the drug smuggling especially has become just out of control with it's amazing, really, because like you said, you know, we have it all here. So you would expect the market to be saturated, but it's not. And especially not because the prison sentences for drugs are not as high. I'm not sure exactly on how it works, but if you get caught with, you know, millions in drug money or some weapons or some... Well, weapons are a problem still, because we consider those more dangerous than drugs. So, but if you're caught with drugs, you might, you know, get busted for several hundred kilos, but you can get out within a decade. You know, it's not like you get sentenced for a lot of years. So you can make a lot of money with a, you know, hardly any risk. It's not like in the U.S. where if you have a gram of cocaine, they could send you away for life if they feel like it, you know. So I think that really attracts a lot of these drug bosses from all around the world to set up camp here and just organize drug deals, just nonstop. You have British over here, you have Irish over here, you have people from the Middle East who have immigrated to the Netherlands, who have set up drug pipelines with their home country, growing the hashish and the weed back home in the Middle East, in Morocco, and then shipping it over to here. And then from here, it goes to England or it goes to Ireland. That kind of stuff is happening a lot at the moment.
Is part of that a result of the European Union and the fact that because all those countries came together as a union of countries and they opened up their borders so that there are no stops, that people took advantage of that? You know, now they can, like you say, they can import the stuff into Antwerp or there in the Netherlands and then ship it throughout pretty much most of Europe without anybody ever stopping their vehicle.
In modern times now, a lot of mainly organized crime in Europe has morphed into, and same way in the United States, the drug business, because it's so lucrative. And the Italian La Cosa Nostra Mafia has pretty much lost any kind of a stranglehold or a domination of that those rackets on it, because it's too lucrative again. And they never really, at least in the United States, they kind of maintain a hands-off as far as narcotics as an organization. They'll have individual members who may do some action, take on a narcotics piece of action, but mainly they just want to invest money in it. So in more modern times, like these illegal casinos and lottery and sports gambling, is there, for example, you can make a sports bet in Las Vegas, but you can't make it in other casinos in the United States. So there's still a book, and the book is always ran by the La Cosa Nostra Mafia, is my experience in the United States. Is there anything like that in modern times in Europe?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's not as big over here. We have online gambling, which is a lot bigger. But, you know, if you look at the American Cosa Nostra, they got a lot of these offshore gambling websites. So the website itself, you can just go onto it, and then you gamble, and you place your bet in Costa Rica. So the American Mafia has done that, you know, setup. And I think that if you're looking at European gambling, we have a similar kind of thing where you go to a website, place your bet on soccer or football or tennis, and it's actually gotten to the point where I think you had the same thing in the NFL and in baseball, where you had corruption, where you had match fixing, where, you know, we all know the story about Arnold Rothstein, who fixed the World Series. And I think in Europe, we're hearing a lot more stories about big soccer matches being fixed by the mafia. That's not the American mafia, but it's the Italian mafia, the groups from you know, Calabria, the Drangheta. You have the Camorra and Cosa Nostra, where they infiltrate these soccer teams, or they get to certain people and they manage to get a, you know, if you can bet on who gets the first yellow card or who gets the first throw-in, when the ball goes over the line and another player has to throw the ball back into the game, you can actually bet on that. So if you know, if you bribe a certain player and you ask him, you know, hey, if you put the ball out and you throw it back in that minute, you got a lot of money on the line. And what we're seeing right now, and we never really believed that that could happen with our local football teams or soccer teams, but right now we're realizing that what happened back in the day with American baseball and American football is actually happening to our own, you know, lovely game as well. If you're looking at these activities, I think you're going to see a lot of the Italian mafia being involved, but also the Chinese gambling syndicate. Because these guys are far, far away, and they have absolutely, there would be no reason for them to be involved in gambling on a second grade team somewhere in a faraway competition in Finland, for instance, or Sweden. But that's what they're doing. They're trying to get these small teams and smaller competitions, and they're trying to bribe players and then bet massively on it. And for some reason, that's a huge business. And that's what we're seeing right now. And, you know, I don't know if there's Italian-American mobsters involved in that. It could well be because, you know, Las Vegas is still the mecca of gambling, and you have a lot of these offshore gambling websites run by American mobsters. So it could very well be that they have a certain in with a lot of these guys. But that's the trend you're seeing right now, that you have gambling on soccer and online gambling especially, and you have syndicates trying to get close to certain players so they can throw a game.
You know, we had our problems, and we have had even maybe up into the 50s that kind of got less. But I know in the modern times, the NFL, for example, will hire a recently retired FBI agent as to do two things. Many times they hired another guy who was a retiree to just give drug tests to the players. But all they do is just go into the locker rooms, go into the they have complete access to the locker rooms, to the umpire's locker room, which nobody else really has this access in the locker rooms in baseball and football, both in the NFL and the Major League Baseball. And develop sources within that and work with the local FBI and the local police who investigate gambling activities and just do nothing but monitor and look for those kinds of things. And that started really big time back in the 70s. You guys are probably going to have to do something like that with the soccer if they haven't already started doing that.
I think the difficulty with Europe is that you have all these countries, so where all we don't have any borders, but we don't have... we're not like one country, you know, so you have all these different countries. They don't have any borders, and there's hardly any unified rules. There's no laws that govern all these countries and all these competitions. So I think that's the biggest obstacle if you're trying to combat, you know, illegal match fixing, or illegal, it's always illegal, but match fixing in Europe. I think the difference in America is that you can send a FBI agent to these teams in every city, in every state. But in Europe, you don't have that. You know, you have local cops, and they might go there, but they have no clue what's happening.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, if it's a Spanish team, you would have to use a Spanish cop and apply Spanish laws. If it was Italian, it would be Italian law. It was, you know, all the other different little countries. Wow, that's I never thought about that. That is a problem.
Well, wait a second. You're not even necessarily talking about professional sports, though, are you? You're really talking about maybe even like a high school level, or I don't know if there's a college level soccer programs where they're making gambling bets on these games.
Well, that's what we all thought was the small time clubs. Now we realize that it's the small time clubs. You know, these are basically like you know, second grade competitions. But we realize now that they even fixed several World Cup games. So that's the biggest. You know, it's bigger than the Super Bowl. There's more people watching the World Cup every 4 years than there's people watching the Super Bowl. So they even got to matches on that level. So once you get to that level and you get to the Champions League, which is like all the best club teams in the Europe, they play each other year-round to become the best of the best. And they even fix those kinds of games. So there's just so much going on that we just sort of like ignored because we believed in the game. I think the Americans had that as well back in the day in the NFL. And, you know, these are our sports heroes. So we do not doubt that these guys are there to, you know, play the best that they can do for the team. But, you know, it turns out it's different. You know, some of these guys, they get in with a certain girl maybe at a certain club, and the girl turns out to be, a prostitute working for a certain criminal. And then they, you know, they have something incriminating on this guy so they can pressure him to maybe throw a game or maybe do something else. And that's how it starts. Now, once one guy on a team is infiltrated, he can actually manipulate other players to follow his lead, or maybe even, you know, if there's a lot of money to be made. So a lot of these players, they might be at the top at a certain point, but some of them will never make it to that level. So once they hear that they can make maybe 200,000, you know, euros or dollars on just one action during one game, they'll do it. You know, but once they do that one action, they can't go back. So once they're in for life, and they know that. So it's very hard to find people willing to talk about that, admit that they were in the wrong. So we had Michael Francese, the Colombo Capo. He was actually talking to people involved in tennis about the dangers of illegal gambling and match fixing and stuff like that, and how the mob would operate to pressure these kinds of players into, you know, getting them to do stuff for them.
Oh, really? He was like, Michael Francese? He's like a consulting with them on the danger. That's interesting. Get it right from the horse's mouth, or at least somebody that learned it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, and you're not talking about the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You're talking really about today?
Yeah, recent years. I think Michael Francese talking to, I think it was the U.S. Open tennis tournament. He was talking to several players about the dangers of gambling and the dangers of, you know, these criminals trying to influence you to, you know, just, it's never really about losing a certain game, but it's about, like, it all always starts with a small thing. Like in tennis, it could be, you know what, first play, you know, throw the first game, you know, the first game, you know, just go down for like 40 love, which is like, you know, you make no points in the first game. That's like, you're not losing the entire match. You're just throwing one little piece of it. And most players would say, well, that's not so bad, but it's a start. And Michael Francese, probably, I'm not sure, but I'm thinking that's what he does. He's explaining to these players, you know, once you do that, look, you can't go back. Once you've done that, you have to remember that you're in there now. You know, you're in this for life. Or, you know, you admit what you've done, and then you get expelled from your beautiful sports career. So it's sort of like a lose-lose. You know, you can't make any money with these guys once you're in, because once you're in, you have to continue, you know, throwing games and throwing maybe even matches. And at one point, your whole career is dead.
That's true. Once they own you, as you talked about earlier, I think the first program about, you know, if you do business with these people, then they feel like they own you. And once you do a little bit of business with them, they feel like they own you for life. Anything you do is a betrayal, and you don't want to betray these guys.
And once you've done something for them, they know that, you know, you can't go back either, because they will hold that over your head and tell everyone that you know that you worked for them. And at that point, you know, there's nothing you can do, because if you would, you know, if they would tell people and tell police or tell whoever, it's your career that's down. You know, they'll just go on to the next guy.
Yeah,
so you have to really keep that in mind, you know. That, of course, that's like the feel good story, because, you know, if you start pushing, they might kill you, or they break a leg, or they break an arm, and that's your whole career. So for these athletes, they really need to watch it.
That's true. Well, David, this has been great. We're gonna start winding down here now. We really appreciate you coming on and talking with us about the history of the influence of the American La Cosa Nostra Mafia in England, and straighten us out about, you know, what kind of action that they did over there, what the lay of the land, if you will, is in English, particularly with the Cray brothers. Always the Cray twins. I always had that question in my mind, and I guess I never really read a comprehensive book on them. I probably will do that now and take a little closer look at them, just because I'm a little more interested after talking with you. And then the modern day influence on sports gambling in particular, and how that's developing, much like the professional gamblers and the professional grant gambling class, and the illegal betting on sports operations, has how it progressed in the United States, and what's going on in Europe today in regards to soccer and tennis, which are the huge sports over there. What about cricket? I'm curious. Is there a book or a line on cricket matches?
I think so. Yeah, I think, I'm not sure, because cricket is only big in Britain and Australia and India.
Okay.
But I do believe that in in India, I think several players have been caught match fixing. So definitely going down there as well.
All right. Well, great. Folks, if you want to be entertained and educated and enlightened about the international organized crime families, the Russian mafia, the Yakuza, and other families like that, European families, go to David's website. It is www.gangstersinc.org. That's www.gangstersinc.org. That's like Gangsters Incorporated. And check that out. Subscribe and share it with your friends, and because it is entertaining and enlightening. David writes in a very entertaining but factual manner. He does not delve off into fictionalization of anything that I've seen. You'll find a story by me about the founding of the American secret police. It's kind of secret. The law enforcement intelligence units across the United States, which were formed to fight traveling professional criminals, of which La Cosa Nostra families were the primary offenders and of traveling professional criminal of the traveling professional criminal class. Well, that's hard to spit that out two or three times, David. We're really glad that you could be here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I had a blast.
I'm looking at his website right now. Here's an article. Looks like he has from a friend of ours that we've talked to, Mr. Lindblom.
Oh, yeah, Gunnar Allen Lindblom. He's done some stuff on your site. I didn't really realize that. I knew he was doing some stuff on the National Crime Syndicate site.
Here's a story that entitled, How I Became an Enforcer for the Detroit Mafia Family.
Interesting. Did you talk to him by phone? He's an interesting guy.
Not yet. I hope to in the future. Right now, he's just writing certain pieces for me, and he's really going like madman right now. Since he's been out, he's been writing nonstop. It's like every week there's a new article out.
I've noticed that. We've got a two-episode series of him coming up. When his book gets released, I'm going to release that probably about the middle of April. So, you know, there's an insatiable demand for information about organized crime, no matter what. One thing I've never gone into is to the Chinese triads and Tong societies. I need to take a look at that one of these days, and sound like you may know something about that, David.
Yeah, definitely.
The Russian mafia.
And the Russian mafia. I've never done anything on that. Well, we'll have to get back with David and have another program or two on those subjects. Would you be willing to come back and talk with us on those, David?
Yeah, I would love to come back, man.
All right. Well, I think it's time that I gave my public service announcement, folks. It's if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or you have a friend or relative or a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. You can call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can get your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. Also, buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon as a streaming download, or you can buy it. And get the book that Gary has out now, Leaving Vegas.
How the FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. And I have another book, Aaron, and if you want to, I haven't quite got it done yet. It'll be another, by the time this goes up, it'll be done. If you subscribe to my website, I will send you either a free Kindle version or just a PDF file, if you don't have a Kindle, of my new short book on surveillance techniques. And I'll use a lot of my own personal experiences on how to conduct surveillances. And from that, you might be able to figure out how you can avoid surveillances or spot surveillances. You can't really avoid them, but you can spot them pretty quick. If you're out there worrying about the police following you around, and I can give you some tips out of my experience on how to spot those cops that are nosing around. Now, if you're really doing something really bad, you're never going to spot them following you around. But for you in-between guys that get a little paranoid, this will give you tips on how to spot surveillance. All right, Aaron, I think that's all I got to say. Say goodnight, David.
Goodnight, David.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Gary. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.